Those who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Ron Bickelman. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 25th and 26th issue of the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. U.S.-Canada fight upends trade talks. Prime Minister Mark Carney of Canada said he was ready to resume trade negotiations when the Americans are ready, one day after President Trump said he was terminating the talks because of the anti-tariff advertisement campaign sponsored by the Ontario government. Doug Ford, the premier of the province, said on Friday that after talking with Carney, he would pause its U.S. ad campaign effective Monday. But the White House waved away Carney's conciliatory comments with spokesperson Kush Desai saying, "Further talks are a futile effort if Canada can't be serious." The dispute injects a new uncertainty in the U.S.-Canada relations at a critical time for both economies. In addition to recent talks on the steel and aluminum tariffs, the nations are also preparing for a review of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement scheduled for next year. That review is statutorily mandated by the USMCA agreement that Trump signed in 2020, but neither the White House nor its U.S. Trade Representative would say if Trump would seek to delay or cancel conversations with Canada on treaty because of the advertising dispute. Days before Trump canceled trade talks with Canada, he had publicly minimized the ad in his Truth Social platform. The Ontario government started running an ad in the U.S. earlier this month. At a Tuesday event with Republican senators, Trump said that he had seen the advertisement and said, "If I were Canada, I'd take that same ad also." His tone shifted markedly on Thursday night and on Friday when he accused the Canadian government of trying to influence the Supreme Court ahead of its high-stakes hearing over the fate of his so-called reciprocal tariff scheduled for November 5th. Canada, Trump wrote in a second post on Friday morning, is attempting to illegally influence the court in one of the most important rulings in the history of our country. The Ontario ad uses audio from 1987 radio address delivered by former President Ronald Reagan, in which he explains that despite putting tariffs on Japanese semiconductors in that year, he was committed to free trade policies. While tariffs look patriotic, Reagan said, over the long run, such trade barriers hurt every American worker and consumer, lead to fierce trade wars, and result in lost jobs. The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute said on social media Thursday night, shortly before the Trump comments, that the ad misrepresented Reagan's address. The Ontario government didn't ask for permission to use the audio, the foundation said, adding that it is reviewing its legal options. The foundation didn't say what was inaccurate about the ad. It also didn't respond to comment requests on Friday. Canada has used an ad campaign before to try to sway public opinion against the tariffs. In March, the country put up ads on digital billboards in 12 U.S. states declaring tariffs are attacks on hardworking Americans. Ontario's Ford had irked U.S. officials by removing U.S. alcohol from the province's state-run liquor stores. In March, he threatened to cut off electricity exports to Michigan, Minnesota, and New York State, which prompted Trump to double steel and aluminum tariffs. Though Ford backed off at the time, he again brandished a threat in Ontario this month that U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick told a room full of Canadian executives and policymakers that the U.S. was determined to shift auto manufacturing from Canada to the U.S. White House officials depicted the incident as a result of longstanding difficulties with Ottawa, contrasting the optimism of Canadian officials. For Carney, the disruption comes at a critical time. The Canadian leader has been coming under pressure from opposition politicians to show that he can get Trump back to back down on his tariffs. He won a general election in April by promising to guide Canada's economy through an unprecedented crisis and stand up to Trump's threat to rupture Canada's largely tariff-free trading relationship with the U.S. National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett said the Canadians have been very difficult to negotiate with, adding that frustration has built up over time as the administration is currently negotiating with Mexico separately despite the presence of the three-way free trade agreement. Some senior Trump officials, including Lutnick and U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer, have publicly floated the breaking the Tri-Nation Pact into two separate bilateral agreements, an option Trump has signaled openness to, but hasn't endorsed outright. On Friday, Carney said that before getting onto a plane for the Association of Southeastern Asian Nations Summit in Kuala Lumpur, that he remains open to keep the talks going with the U.S. Both he and Trump will attend a working dinner for Asian Pacific leaders on Wednesday in South Korea and are likely to see each other, a senior official said. The government of Canada has had very constructive, in-depth, detailed discussions with the United States to try to make progress in the steel, aluminum, energy sectors as well as other sectors, he said, speaking in French. We are ready to continue building on that progress when the Americans are ready. Inflation accelerates to 3%, but it is less than expected. Annual inflation heated up slightly in September, but not as much as economists expected, giving the Federal Reserve a clear path for widely expected rate cuts heading into the remaining meetings this year. Consumer prices rose 3% from a year earlier, the Labor Department said Friday, slightly hotter than August's increase of 2.9% and the fastest pace since January. Measure of core prices that strips out volatile food and energy costs also increased 3%. Both came in below economists' expectations of 3.1% rise as pressure on housing costs eased. Inflation remains a sticky issue with price increases above where policymakers wanted them. The latest report indicates retailers continue to pass some tariff-related costs on to consumers, contributing to higher prices for items such as apparel and sporting goods. Still, latest figures also show that inflation is improving to be a big worry, as Fed officials originally feared when President Trump announced big tariff increases in the spring. The U.S. collected around $30 billion in tariff revenue in September alone, but companies haven't passed all those costs on to consumers. Some have used loopholes and exemptions to avoid higher levies. September reading keeps the Fed on track to cut interest rates again at its meetings next week as policymakers grapple with slowdown in hiring. If the milder-than-expected pace of price growth continues, it would soften resistance to rate cuts from officials who have been more anxious about inflation. Stock markets climbed on the news Friday. The Dow Industrials rose 472.51 points. The Blue Chip Index's 1% gain put it above the 47,000 at the close for the first time. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ Composite also rose to records. Tariff-related inflation will remain a concern for the near term, but it is the job market that is becoming the more pressing issue for the Fed, with a clear chance that the low-fire economy becomes a no-fire, let's-fire story, said James Knightley, chief international economist at ING, in a note to clients after the release of the CPI data. Friday's report was more than a week late because a shutdown had stopped work on economic data. The government decided to issue the inflation report, which is needed to determine cost of living increases for Social Security payments. Jobs data are still on hold. The White House said on social media Friday that the shutdown means there likely won't be a report on October inflation, since surveyors who collect price information can't work in the field. U.S. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt credited the September numbers to Trump's economic agenda. Month over month, prices rose 0.3% in September, below expectations of 0.4%. Core prices rose 0.2%. Still, some tariff-sensitive categories posted outsized price rises in September. Apparel jumped 0.7%, to the sharpest month-over-month increase in a year, while furniture and bedding rose 0.9%, and sporting goods increased 1% from August. Energy prices rose sharply month-over-month, led by a jump in gasoline. Food costs increased at a slower pace than in August. Overall, inflation remains a frustration for consumers, said Bill Adams, chief economist at Comerica Bank. Coffee prices, which are highly sensitive to tariffs, were up 18.9% in September from a year earlier. Beef prices were up 14.7%. The month-over-month drop in used car prices likely reflects financial pressure on lower to middle-income consumers who are pulling back on purchases, Adams said. September inflation was slightly cooler than economists expected, partly because of surprisingly modest increases in rent and a measure of housing costs. The housing market has been weighed down by high interest rates and surge in new apartment construction after the pandemic. The latest inflation report also offers hints that the Trump administration's immigration crackdown is contributing to higher prices in some service categories that rely on immigrant labor, Adam said. The cost of gardening and lawn care services rose 13.9% year over year, and the cost of caring for those in need of long-term care and elderly at home rose 11.6%. At the same time, lower immigration could ease the pressure on housing costs in the near term by reducing the demand for homes. Inflation remains top of mind for many consumers, according to the survey data. University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index fell 53.6 in October from 55.1 in September, which represents voicing frustration about the persistently high prices. Thierry Witzman, global interest rate and foreign exchange strategist at Macquarie, said the latest report shows sticky inflation and offers little justification for aggressive Fed rate cuts. I don't think there was much good news, he said. Employers added just 22,000 jobs in August, last month for which the Labor Department data is available. More recent data from the Bank of America payroll processor ADP in a number of surveys suggest hiring remained weak in September. The government slowdown, now in its fourth week, and the absence of economic data have made it harder for policymakers to parse the double threat of above-target inflation and the slowing jobs growth. NBA bets big on gambling, wins itself a crisis. When federal agents announced charges against more than 30 people involved in a sprawling gambling probe on Thursday morning, the specifics of the case were gripping. There were underdog poker games, x-ray tables, tips whispered to bettors about where to put their money in professional basketball games. But for the NBA, the general picture that emerged at a Brooklyn news conference across East River from the league's Fifth Avenue offices was much more chilling. Prosecutors unveiled an indictment that featured an active player, a retired one, and a current head coach spilling secrets to illegal gamblers. It was a fraud, FBI Director Kash Patel said, that these perpetrators committed on the grand stage of the NBA. Also, existential threat to professional sports and perhaps the defining crisis of Adam Silver's tenure as NBA commissioner. Silver was an early proponent of legalized sports gambling in the U.S. and had long argued that legal betting would have a positive effect of bringing criminal behavior such as manipulating and fixing games into light. Thursday's arrest showed the vulnerability in Silver's argument. Technology has turned gambling into a widespread habit on a scale too vast for any league to police. All fans now carry a casino in their pocket, and the number of bets per game has grown exponentially, putting sports leagues in the same boat as social media companies trying to root out inappropriate content. The allegations unveiled across two indictments touched nearly every corner of the league. Terry Rozier, an active player, was charged with fraud after allegedly telling a friend that he'd be pulling himself out of a game early so the friend could bet on it. Damon Jones, a retired player and former assistant coach, was accused of participating in a rigged poker games and passing along confidential team information for illegal wagers. Chauncey Billups, a Hall of Fame player and now head coach of the Trailblazers, was also charged with participating in illegal poker games backed by organized crime families. But the indictment further suggests that he fed insider information about his team to the betting ring. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The NBA has placed Billups and Rozier on leave. We take these allegations with the utmost seriousness, the league said, and the integrity of our game remains our top priority. For any sports league, learning that the federal investigators had accused its players and coaches of colluding with gamblers would be a catastrophe, but it is especially stinging in the case of the NBA. Over a decade ago, when sports betting apps weren't legally available, Silver was one of the earliest and most influential advocates for legalized sports gambling. Congress should adapt a federal framework that allows states to authorize betting on a professional sports, Silver wrote in a New York Times opinion piece in 2014, subject to strict regulatory requirements and technological safeguards. Since then, every other major league has followed Silver's lead. Legalized gambling quickly developed into a booming industry, and sportsbooks have flooded leagues with money through advertising, product fees, and fan engagement. It is impossible to watch the National Football League or Major League Baseball game without seeing ads for gambling companies during commercial breaks. In fact, on Thursday, when the panel on ESPN's flagship morning show discussed the charges, the network scrambled to remove an advertisement for ESPN Bet Sportsbook on the bottom of the screen. But feeding the growth of sports gambling carried risks like those laid out in the week's indictments. Though Rozier was investigated by the league after a March 2023 game, the NBA didn't find any violations of its rules. Rozier played two more seasons with the Charlotte Hornets and Miami Heat, collecting about $50 million in salary until his arrest. His lawyer said he intends to fight the charges against him. Billups was charged only over his involvement in rigged poker games. While prosecutors said he was recruited to lure in wealthy players and pocketed a share of the proceeds. But in a separate sports betting indictment, prosecutors alleged that co-conspirator 8, an unnamed player turned coach whose description and career timeline matched Billups exactly, knew that the Trailblazers intend to arrest their players on March 24th, 2023, one day after Rozier left his game with an apparent injury. The co-conspirator fed the information to bettors, who placed about $100,000 on wagers on Portland to lose that night before the injury details were released to the public and betting lines removed. They profited when Portland lost by 28 points. Billups' lawyer denied the accusations against him and also said he intends to fight them. Jones, who played alongside LeBron James and later coached him in Cleveland, is also accused of parlaying his privileged position into a betting edge. The former teammates remain close friends and work together in an unofficial capacity that gave Jones access to the Los Angeles Lakers, James' current team. The government said Jones reportedly tried to sell inside information to another member of the poker rigging crew. February 2023, days after James set the NBA all-time scoring record, he had a sore ankle before he was listed as out for the injury report. Jones also alerted another unnamed co-conspirator, get a big bet on Milwaukee tonight before the information is out. In all, the sports betting indictment alleges that participants in the scheme tried to leverage insider information about no fewer than four NBA players in addition to Rozier. Betting crises aren't unique to the NBA. Baseball has dealt with spot fixing, where a pitcher might throw a single ball on purpose instead of a strike. NFL has suspended a number of players for betting on games. But basketball has proven especially susceptible to foul play, it didn't raise eyebrows when the Blazers willingly benched their best players for a night in the hopes of securing a higher draft pick, a common practice known as tanking. And one booming corner of sports betting is prop bets, placed not on the score of the game, but on a single statistic such as how many rebounds a player might grab. Basketball, a game of constant motion, has many such prop bets to offer or manipulate. On Tuesday, the day the NBA season tipped off, Silver himself called for tighter regulations on betting, especially when it comes to prop bets for lesser players. "We've asked some of our partners to pull back some of the prop bets," Silver said on ESPN. Just 2 days later, the FBI had arrested a player signed to a $96 million contract on an acquaintance of the league's most famous current player and coach, who was already enshrined in the basketball's Hall of Fame. The night before the FBI news conference, Billups had chosen an unfortunate metaphor to describe how he responds to pressure. "I do the best I can," Billups said, "and let the chips fall where they may." Continuing along now, Z thinks he has Trump's number. During his first term, President Trump often frustrated Xi Jinping with a freewheeling mix of threats and bonhomie. This time, the Chinese leader believes he has cracked the code. Xi has thrown out China's traditional diplomatic playbook and tailored a new one specifically for Trump, said people close to the Chinese policymakers, who described Xi as appearing confident and emboldened. The new strategy, these people said, embraces Trump's self-image as a master dealmaker, offering concessions on high-visibility issues he personally cares about, such as the fate of popular video sharing apps TikTok. But when the Trump administration hits China, Xi decided to hit back even harder in a bid to gain leverage over Trump while projecting strength and unpredictability, qualities he believes the president admires. People said the two leaders are set to meet next Thursday in South Korea. Xi's strategic evolution takes a page from Trump's own maximum pressure playbook of using the threat of overwhelming economic sanctions to get his way against adversaries and friends alike. According to those familiar with Beijing thinking, while China's reactions to the U.S. trade assaults were often proportional in the past, its countermeasures are now designed to be more severe. During Trump's first term, China has constantly put off balance by his pressure tactics, said Kurt Campbell, a former Deputy Secretary of State under President Joe Biden and now chairman of the Asia Group, an advisory board and firm in Washington. This time, Xi wanted to be prepared. He knows Trump wants a good relationship with him and respects strength, not concessions. Power play. The most powerful example of the new strategy came earlier this month when Washington and Beijing were trying to finalize South Korea's summit. Just when relations seemed on the mend, Xi dropped a bombshell. He directed his government to hit back at recent U.S. export control action and to do so with unprecedented force, according to people close to Beijing. On October 9th, China's Ministry of Commerce unveiled broad restrictions on both exports and rare earth materials that threaten to upend global production of everything from phones, laptops, and cars to missiles. China produces around 90% of the world's refined rare earths. Publicly, Chinese officials said the move was simply a tit-for-tat response to the new U.S. rule extending restrictions on tech sales to increase any companies at least half owned by an already blacklisted Chinese entity. In reality, the people close to Beijing said it was also Xi's attempt to gain leverage before Trump meeting, who has shown a desire to strike a broad economic deal with China. Xi's new doctrine is that the U.S. might adapt to a reality of Chinese power, these people said. In rare earths, they said, Xi is convinced that China holds a Trump card that allows it to demand substantial U.S. concessions. Beijing believes it has maximum leverage and is not afraid of using it, said Jimmy Goodrich, a China and technology expert at the University of California. Still, Xi risks a strategic backfire. His tactics provide ammunition to hawks in Washington, pushing to break America's economic dependency on China. U.S. allies in Europe and Asia, who rely on These similar minerals for their own industries were also unsettled by Beijing's heavy-handed display, reinforcing worries that China is becoming an increasingly unpredictable actor on the world stage. First sign of Xi's playbook appeared in April when Trump unleashed his global Liberation Day tariffs. China, already weathering Biden-era restrictions, was hit hard by the U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods, eventually skyrocketing to 145%, and Beijing's retaliation was swift. It cut off rare earth magnets to the U.S. companies, temporarily forcing some U.S. automobile factories to shut down. Blowback. The blowback on Wall Street was immediate. The U.S. bond market went up into a tailspin, and Beijing's counterpunch caused stocks to plummet. For Xi, the market chaos was a signal. According to the people close to Chinese policymakers, he was emboldened to press his advantage, convinced the U.S. lacked the stomach for more economic pain. In recent trade negotiations, the Chinese have demanded a full capitulation, the removal of all U.S. tariffs and export control measures, though their American counterparts haven't given any ground. The strategy behind the new assertiveness was born from crisis. After Trump's presidential victory last year, anxiety rippled through Beijing. According to people close to policymakers, Xi told top aides, including Chief of Staff Kai Kui, economic czar, his lifelong Communist Party leading ideologue Wang Huning, to urgently design a new playbook for Trump too, one that would break the constant reactive posture that has defined Beijing's past approach. In a statement, China's foreign ministry said both countries should address mutual concerns about dialogue and consultation on a basis of equality and mutual benefit. The new approach is rooted in a core belief in Beijing that Trump is fundamentally transactional, not ideological. Policymakers believe that they can use Trump's zest for a deal to neutralize China hawks in his administration. White House spokesman Khush Desai disputed the characterization of the president's deal-making instincts, saying Trump's promise to revitalize American industries and communities. The only deals that Trump is willing to strike are deals that deliver on his pledge of putting Americans and America first, Desai said. Beijing's also trying to go around formal diplomatic and security establishments to get messages straight to Trump through relationships and influence of U.S. business titans. That quiet calculations, balancing pressure with appeasement, now forms the bedrock of China's strategy. In this tense lead-up to trade talks in Madrid this September, Xi knew he needed to offer a concession to get what he truly wanted, summits with Trump to hash out issues one-on-one. The concessions with TikTok for Trump forcing the sale of the high-profile app was a populist victory framed around national security. For Xi, the app was a low-cost bargaining chip. He had privately dismissed it as spiritual opium, according to people close to Beijing, and viewed it as an easy sacrifice to secure continued dialogue China needed. As a result, Xi set the stage for a series of summits with Trump. The meeting next week in South Korea, Beijing hopes to arrange a Trump visit to China early next year. And finally, Xi's trip to the U.S. late in 2026. At the top of Xi's agenda is the critical issue of Taiwan. With Trump signaling interest in new economic accord, the Chinese leader plans to use these meetings to press Trump to move beyond the longstanding policy of strategic ambiguity and formally state that the U.S. opposes Taiwan's independence. In another sign of transactional approach, ahead of the expected leaders' summit, Beijing is considering a significant purchase of American soybeans, a request put forward by Trump. Xi's new playbook, hawks grounded. Xi's new playbook is gaining some ground in the administration, where cabinet secretaries now carefully curate their advice to Trump, selectively choosing what to present and how to hold back, said people familiar with the White House dynamics. Below the cabinet level, these people said many traditional Chinese hawks have been marginalized, including Peter Navarro, a longtime trade advisor to Trump. Senior administration officials said that even Navarro's television appearances have declined. He's still involved in formulating Chinese policies. In a statement, Navarro said, just as in the first Trump term, my job today is to help create jobs, improve wages, and fix supply chain vulnerabilities. The difference this time is that I don't have to fight the Secretaries of Commerce, Treasury, and the War to move Trump's agenda. One band, one sound. As other officials who pushed for tougher line on China have left the administration, security and tech experts began to worry that a vacuum had been created, one that could be filled by those more interested in business ties with Beijing than in challenging ambitions. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The vacuum, these experts said, providing an opening for influential business leaders, most notably NVIDIA Chief Executive Jensen Huang, said in an appeal to Trump in the summer, Huang argued that the ban on selling the company's H2O artificial intelligence chip to China would only accelerate Beijing's push for technological self-sufficiency. Trump decided to reverse the ban. As the NVIDIA spokesperson said, the company works with governments across the world. We do not engage in geopolitical and diplomatic discussions between governments. White House spokesperson Desai said the era of Washington, D.C. politicians selling out our country and compromising America's national security at behest of special interest groups ended the day President Trump took office. To deliver on his pledge to put Americans first, Desai said President Trump has assembled the best and most experienced economic and national security team in modern history. Sanctions package. According to people with knowledge of the events, the administration has prepared a decision memo outlining a package of secondary sanctions against China for its purchases of Russian oil, a move intended to give U.S. leverage over both China and Russia. The memo also sent to Trump for a final decision. Before his meeting with Putin, Trump decided against the sanctions package, the people said, probably to avoid direct retaliation from Beijing. China's success, however, may have bred the overconfidence behind Beijing's latest sweeping controls on rare earths. The move enraged the White House. The Trump group threatened to retaliate with 100% tariffs on Chinese goods and cancel the summit with Xi. The backlash triggered a hastily softening of the tone from Beijing. On October 12th, China's Ministry of Commerce had issued a statement promising to implement the controls in a prudential and moderate manner. Beijing's quick backtrack underscores the U.S. continues to hold significant leverage. Senior administration officials, including Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, have said China remains critically dependent on American products such as jet engines. A lot of access to such high and products could thwart China's own technological and strategic ambitions. Gazans pass from one hell onto another. Palestinians freed by Israel are trying to grasp a new reality in the ravaged enclave. For more than 20 months during the two-year war in Gaza, Dr. Ahmad Manna was locked away in Israel's prison network with thousands of other Palestinians taken from Gaza. When he returned to the enclave this month as part of the Prisoners for Hostages exchange deal, he said he left one grim reality for another. Life in Gaza, like prison, has been torturous, full of suffering and hunger, Mana said. In prison, I hadn't experienced feeling a full stomach in more than 600 days. I came to learn that my wife, who in Gaza the whole time, hadn't either. Roughly 1,700 Palestinians detained by Israel in the past year recently returned to Gaza. Many are trying to reacclimate into a shattered society and figure out what's next. 2 months after the deadly Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attacks, the Israeli parliament passed an amendment that extended how long alleged unlawful combatants could be laid out without access to legal counsel or without being brought before a judge. The Israeli military had, since 2023, detained thousands of Palestinians under the law, which defines an unlawful combatant as a person who has participated either directly or indirectly in hostile acts against Israel. Hundreds of Palestinians remain held under the law, which rights groups say has led to arbitrary detentions. The Wall Street Journal has reported on detainees experiencing harsh treatment, including beatings, psychological abuse, food deprivation, crowded and unsanitary conditions, and being denied requests for medical care and legal counsel. The Israeli Prison Service the Israel Prison Service said it wasn't aware of such treatment occurring under its watch, adding that it operates in accordance with the law and that rights of inmates are upheld, including access to medical care and adequate living conditions. Mana, who was working as director of Al-Wadi Hospital in Gaza during its first months of the war, said Israeli soldiers accused his hospital of harboring militants, which led to his detention in December of 2023. The doctor denied the allegations and said he was given access to an attorney only twice in 2 years. His home is in Gaza City, Tel El-Hua neighborhood, which pre-war has more affluent districts than roughly translate into Windy Hill. He didn't recognize streets that he once saw as full of life. When I came back, it was a hill of rubble and sand, said Maha, whose family had been displaced from the area to Deir el-Balah in central Gaza. He's hoping to send his teenage children to live in Egypt or Jordan so they can continue their education. In Gaza, there are essentially no schools, no universities left, he said. Maha says he plans to stay in Gaza because of the acute need for medical professionals. I'm staying there. There is a lot of work to do, he said. I just need 10 days or so to rest and recover. Former detainees said they went extended periods without information on their relatives or the war in Gaza. Some disappeared without their families knowing where they were or whether they were alive. They were held without being formally charged or tried and entered a detention network where their cases were based on evidence to which defendants and their lawyers, if they had one, didn't get access, said Jessica Montel, executive director of HaMoked, an Israel legal and humanitarian organization. We don't exactly know what the bar for being detained is because it's all based on secret evidence, she said. It's very rare for detainees to have a lawyer present. Many Gazans we spoke with didn't even know they were being held as unlawful combatants. The Israel military said Israeli law grants detainees the right to legal representation and that classified information is being used for investigations. For reasons relating to safeguarding information, security, and sources, it's understood that classified intelligence information cannot be provided to the detainees, the military said. While what some detainees described as a nightmare finally ended, the returns of Gaza have been bittersweet. Shadi Abu Saido, a 35-year-old Gazan released in October after being held in Israeli custody since March of 2024, said he didn't recognize the enclave. I kept asking the Red Cross, where am I? This can't be Gaza. This looks like the end of the world, he said. Sleep escapes Abu Saido, he said. I wake up in the middle of the night with nightmares, he said. I am haunted by what I have seen. Abu Saido said he found his home in Gaza in pieces. Now I'm trying to rebuild my life. I'm looking for a tent if I can find one, he said. I came out of one hell and into another. In the exchange, Travis Kelce is here to save Six Flags. The stars of the Super Bowl always celebrate in the same way. They bask in confetti, host the Lombardi Trophy, and then proclaim where they plan to celebrate their epic victory. I'm going to Disney World. Travis Kelce wins the fourth Super Bowl this NFL season. There are hundreds of millions of reasons why he might pick a different amusement park. The Kansas City Chiefs star tight end just joined an activist investor campaign that's targeting Six Flags. New York-based Jana Partners and other investors put in around $200 million to buy roughly 9% of the theme park operator. That means Kelce is now part owner in trying to sell America's on stomach-churning drops, head-spinning turns, and dipping dots, just what he loved as a kid. On the surface, a 36-year-old football player teaming up with rabble-rousing investors might seem like an unlikely and as likely as getting engaged to the world's most famous pop star after talking after talking about her on a podcast. But as the two sides got to know one another, they realized the partnership was kismet and ripe opportunity to revitalize an iconic American brand. Kelsey, in recent years, has developed a wide-ranging investment portfolio, mostly in business. He's passionate about beer, games, and clothing, and he's often done it alongside his institutional investors. Kelsey's business team had Jana on its list of potential partners. Jana, meanwhile, has had some surprising partners in past deals, knew about Kelsey's work on consumer brands, and viewed the Ohio native self-described roller coaster superfan as perfect for the Six Flags campaign. Stay tuned. Each year, activist investors and other hedge fund managers flock to 13D Monitor Active Passive Investor Summit at the Pierre Hotel in New York to unveil new investments, talk about shop and their strategies to pressure management teams to make changes, and gossip on the sidelines about their peers before John and managing partner Scott Ostfeld took the stage Tuesday afternoon. Attendees heard from Cracker Barrel's chief executive about the restaurant chain's disastrous logo change, from activist fund Starboard Value about why TripAdvisor should pursue a sale, among other ideas. Cell phones in the audience lighted up with Wall Street Journal News alert that Jana and Kelsey had taken a stake in Six Flags. Ostfeld took the mic. Six Flags wasn't doing much to fix its technology, but loyalty or improve the customer experience, he said. Jana would push to make deals and promotions more personalized for consumers and reward frequent visitors. Ostfeld's team recently had spent hours trying to buy Six Flags passes to no avail. Even after talking to the company's customer service team, the process wasn't any easier, he said. The ordeal reflected frustrations many theme park fans have faced in the wake of Six Flags' merger with rival Cedar Fair last year. Kelsey wouldn't actively get involved in the efforts to reinvigorate Six Flags' brand and marketing. Kelsey would be actively involved in trying to reinvigorate Six Flags in brand and marketing. Jana was founded in 2001 by Barry Rosenstein, who wanted to be a different kind of activist investor. Rosenstein, who had practiced yoga 6 days a week for decades, thought he could bring about change at companies by building relationships with management. He has largely stated clearly the aggressive tactics often associated with his fellow activists like Carl Icahn and Bill Ackman, who were in their heyday as activists, often penned and publicized nasty letters to executives. Today, Jana has more than $2 billion in assets under management. The managing partner leading Jana's campaign, Ostfeld, has been at the firm for 2 decades and worked on campaigns and companies including Tiffany and Company, Pinnacle Foods, and perhaps world famously Whole Foods before it was sold to Amazon. Ostfeld is known for getting straight to the point. When he delivered his thesis on Six Flags, he opted against using any slides. He advised companies who are targeted that he is open to hearing why his thesis is wrong. One saying in a Chicago keynote talk, "We would accept a good explanation." A spokesman for Six Flags sent in an email that the company appreciates the perspectives of shareholders and takes their feedback seriously, adding that it continues to pursue initiatives to increase attendance and enhance our guest experience and drive profitability, growth, and shareholder value. As Ostfeld walked off the stage at Tuesday's conference, he bumped into another activist investor, Scott Ferguson, managing partner of Sachem Head Capital Management. Sachem had taken a big stake in Six Flags earlier in the year and received a board seat just 4 days earlier. Six Flags shares were shooting up on the news of Jana's involvement, and the two men excitedly scurried away to talk. Kelsey Incorporated, the main event of Wednesday's episode of Kelsey's podcast, which he co-hosts with his brother Jason, was an interview with basketball legend Allen Iverson. Before the conversation got underway. He took a beat to talk about the latest investment. It came across the desk, and I could not pass up an opportunity up, Travis Kelce said. We're going to be part of a theme park and amusement parks that actually rocked our world as kids and hopefully give families nowadays the fun and the memories that we had and we cherished growing up. The discussions didn't feel out of ordinary for any longtime listeners of New Heights. The brothers regularly discussed news in their lives. Just a couple months prior, Kelce's soon-to-be fiancée, Taylor Swift, joined them to announce the title and release of her latest album. They've even talked about their love of amusement parks. It was to build a roller coaster at Six Flags Park. Kelce suggested it should have a drop like Millennium Force at the coaster that was the first in the world to exceed 300 feet in height. Riders' feet should dangle like they do on the Raptor, he said, citing the coaster that flips riders upside down 6 different times. I like being a big guy. I don't gotta worry about my height being an issue on this thing, he said. Both our rides at Cedar Point, Six Flags Park on the shores of Lake Erie in Ohio. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Time is 45 minutes past the hour. His brother chimed in to say that the coaster should be made of wood to add some shakiness into the mix. They reminisced about time spent visiting Cedar Point as children and other Six Flags Park, Kings Island near Cincinnati, when in that area for training camps. Those days, specifically given his NFL stardom and world-famous fiancé, there's no shortage of companies reaching out to partner with the tight end. Kelce has now invested in over 30 companies and industries, including manufacturing, distribution, consumer goods, software, entertainment, and even beer. Kelce and his advisors prefer to find their own deals, focusing on businesses he has experience with in his day-to-day life. The Kelce brothers drink loads of garage beer before they became the largest investor in an up-and-coming beer brand. Andy Sauer, CEO of Garage Beer, says that while Jason brings creative panache, Travis has an uncanny instincts. It's the same trait he turned into one of the greatest tight ends in the NFL, given how he gets open by running a predestined route instead of just knowing where to find a soft spot in the defense. You see it on the football field, Sauer says. He sees things that other people miss, unlike other big-name athletes who might tie themselves to early-stage companies and hope their celebrity can transform the investment into winning lottery ticket. Kelce usually invests in more established brands where he sees potential for untapped growth. Kelce's team spends months of doing due diligence before putting money in. His portfolio is managed by Andre Enes, founder of talent management firm 3Arts Sports, and private equity veteran Rhodes McKee of Maven Hill Capital. When Kelce ultimately decides to invest in something, it's usually alongside an institutional investor such as a family office or a private equity firm. Previously, at least 4 of those investments have been alongside L. Caterton, a private equity firm backed by luxury goods such as LVMH. One of the stakes was in Chola Hot Sauce, and he made multiplies on his initial investment when the company sold the McCormick & Company. The Six Flags investment checked all the usual boxes for Kelce. He had never been shy about his love for amusement parks. He had also been intrigued by the idea of lending his name to an activist campaign. And in Jaina, he found a partner that was in it like him for the long haul and not a quick flip. We prioritize finding truly authentic partnerships and align with his brand, said Enes, Kelce's business manager. Then we carefully select deals with the investors and the businesses to develop enduring value and a powerful long-term portfolio. Now let's take a look at sports. It's known as America's pastime. Was baseball invented in Canada? A small rural Village, 90 miles south of Toronto, claims that it's the real birthplace of the sport. The championship of baseball's national pastime is starting on Friday in the country that isn't America. The Toronto Blue Jays are in the World Series against the Los Angeles Dodgers and are bringing baseball's signature event abroad for the first time in 32 years. To American fans, it's something of a curiosity, but to Canadians, it represents much more than that. This counts as baseball's homecoming. For decades, the accepted account of baseball's origins was that it was invented by future Civil War General Abner Doubleday in a cow pasture in Cooperstown, New York, in 1839. The story has since been soundly debunked. Doubleday probably wasn't even in Cooperstown at the time. He supposedly created a whole new sport. North of the border, that's not the only reason the Doubleday story doesn't add up. That's because in a small rural village located 90 miles southwest of Toronto, the Dizens of Beachville, Ontario, were already running the bases, all five of them, in an early version of North America's pastime. It became the popular troupe that somehow this was solely an American game. Almost in a culturally imperialist way was imposed on Canadians, said Bill Humber, perhaps Canada's most renowned baseball historian. We've bought into the myth as much as the purveyors of it. Today, the tiny community of about 600 homes has a tattoo parlor, a bunch of in-home businesses, and a few churches. Beachville also boasts a long history of limestone milling. But in 1838, a full year before Doubleday was purported to have rigged up a diamond in Illufini's farmland in upstate New York, Beachville allegedly hosted a baseball game. There are almost no physical relics from what transpired that day. On May 5, 1886, however, Sporting Life magazine published a letter from Dr. Adam Ford, a former mayor of St. Mary's, Ontario, who wrote that he had witnessed a contest in Beachville nearly a half a century earlier that closely resembled our present national game. His recollection is loaded with details. The game was played on a field behind the shop of a local blacksmith. A shoemaker in town constructed the ball out of double twisted woolen yarn covered in calf skin. There were five bases. Home plate was dubbed the knocker stone, and runners could be put out by hitting them with the thrown ball. Still, it was the earliest documented games in baseball history, said Andrew North, director of the Center for Canadian Baseball Research, as it happened in Canada. The border doesn't exist as far as baseball goes, said Brian Chip Martin, author of six books of baseball histories. It's a problem. It's our game, too. There is one major problem with Ford's telling. He was just 7 years old when the game, he recounts, took place. With no one else to back up his assertion, researchers often say his level of specificity makes his story difficult to believe. John Thorne, MLB's official historian, wrote in an email that the Beachville game of 1838 is implausibly recalled as the Doubleday fable. Canadians like to say that Beachville 1838 was 1 year before Cooperstown, he wrote, but neither date holds water. So Canadian historians insist that enough evidence exists to confirm that Beachville happened. The rules Ford laid out are consistent with how the game would have been played back then. The people, he said, played in the game did in fact exist and reside in the Beachville area in 1838. One of the families mentioned, the Burdicks, was discovered to have moved to Beachville from Lanesboro, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires. The next town over, Pittsfield, bypassed a bylaw outlawing baseball to protect its windows of its meeting house all the way back in 1791. Then there's the date of Ford's account, June 4th. That was a holiday in the parts of Canada called Militia Muster Day, where able-bodied men would participate in military training before engaging in recreational activities. Humber has since discovered a mention of an old newspaper of another baseball game played in Hamilton, Ontario in 1819 on the Militia Mustard Day, which he lends credence to Ford's remembrances about Beachville. If he had not gilded by the lily by providing all the unnecessary namentation and detail in his report, if he had just stuck to the basics, I don't think anybody would have questioned it in the first place, nor said. The true beginnings of baseball are murky and can't be pinpointed in one place or time. The game evolved from many other bat and ball games that date back to ancient Egypt, a reality that Martin admits is not satisfying as any actual invention day. But whether the Beachville game transpired exactly as Ford maintained, the idea of baseball there in 1838 shows that the sport was developing in Canada concurrently with the U.S. It's just that Canada's role has been greatly diminished in the American narrative. By the late 19th century, southwestern Ontario had become a hotbed for baseball talent. With the International Association began an alternative to the fledgling National League in 1877. There were two Canadian teams. The London Tecumsehs won the title, the first international baseball champion, North called them, long before the 1992 Blue Jays. In the 1880s, there were even suggestions of Toronto joining the National League. Historians argued that if that had happened, it could have changed the entire directory of baseball in Canada. Instead, hockey took root as Canada's favorite sport. In the early 19th century, baseball was left to America. Now, for 1 year at least, the Blue Jays are hoping to make it back. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 25th and 26th issue of the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition. Your reader has been Ron Bickelman, and thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Volunteer radio readers broadcast daily readings 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, books, and other printed matter to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service has broadcast almost 40 years of radio readings to those without sight. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call 716-821-5555.
Thank you.
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another